following is a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to this week's McGill Alumni Webcast. My name is Derek Kassoff, Managing Director of Communications at McGill's Office of University Advancement. It has now been nearly 4 months since the World Health Organization declared the coronavirus and COVID-19 to be a global pandemic. Since that time, more than 11 million people around the world have been knowingly infected by the virus, and more than 500,000 have died. Some countries, such as South Korea and Germany, have had tremendous success in flattening the curve of infections and hospitalizations, and are now well on their way to reopening their economies and their societies. In other areas, particularly here in the Western Hemisphere, infections and fatalities continue to rise at alarming rates, and reopening is proving to be more difficult. What have we learned about this coronavirus and how it spreads within our communities? What are the most effective ways to stop or greatly slow it down as the world waits for a vaccine? And what should governments and individuals be doing now to avoid an even more devastating second wave this fall? It's Thursday, July 9th, and in this week's McGill Alumni Webcast, Preparing for a Second Wave, Are We Up to the Test?, we sit down with four leading global health experts to explore these questions and try to understand what measures and strategies the scientific community is suggesting we implement ahead of a second wave of infections. Let's introduce our panel. Dr. Tim Evans is a familiar face to regular viewers of this webcast series. He is the inaugural director of McGill School of Population and Global Health, formerly the Assistant Director General at the World Health Organization, and since April, has been heading up the Secretariat overseeing Canada's COVID-19 Immunity Task Force. Welcome back, Dr. Evans. We have Dr. Dick Menzies, a professor in McGill's Faculty of Medicine and a physician and respiratory epidemiologist at the Montreal Chest Institute, as well as associate director of the WHO McGill Collaborating Center for TB Research. Welcome, Dr. Menzies. Dr. Shan Solin is managing director of Pharos Global Health Advisors, a nonprofit strategy and policy advisory organization in Boston, as well as a lecturer at Yale's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs, and a two-time McGill graduate with a BSc in microbiology and immunology and a PhD in experimental medicine. Welcome, Dr. Solin. And finally, Dr. Robert Hecht is a professor of clinical epidemiology at Yale University and president of Pharos Global Health Advisors. He and his family are also strong supporters of McGill's global health program with a focus on student internships and research projects. Welcome to all four of you. What a star-studded panel we have with us today. And if anyone is bound to solve the coronavirus puzzle within the next hour, it could be this quartet. So before we jump into the conversation, a reminder that we did receive many great questions ahead of today's webcast, and we'll be sure to leave ample time at the end for the panel to address some of these. If you are watching live and have a question of your own, you can send it in by email to aoc@mcgill.ca, and we'll try to add it to the list. So let me put my first question to you, Dr. Evans. I think we can all appreciate that this coronavirus has presented the scientific community with many questions and challenges and lots of evolving information. So from your perspective, what are the one or two most important things that we know about the virus today that we didn't know at the beginning of this outbreak? And how has that helped public health officials rethink how to protect societies and manage the crisis?
Well, I think perhaps the most important thing that we've learned is humility, that this virus keeps on raising issues which challenge any orthodoxy that somehow we know it's, we understand it, or that we've seen this before, or it's exactly like flu. So I think we have to have tremendous humility. But if I was going to be specific, I think the one area that has been so fundamental is the area of asymptomatic transmission. And this is the realization that many people who get infected and who are capable of transmitting infection because they're carrying the virus, they're shedding virus, they are showing no symptoms or are feeling well. And because that's such a large number, all of our testing systems that have been directed towards people with symptoms have missed this major part of the transmission. So I think to me, it's this asymptomatic transmission that is probably, for me, the most fundamental learning lesson, because it has challenged the way we've been tracking the disease and demands us to rethink how to track the disease if we're going to recognize asymptomatic transmission as a hallmark of this infection.
Great. Well, thanks for that introduction. And I think it sets up this conversation very well. And I would like actually to move on to the issue of testing right now. That seems to be on everyone's mind these days and is one of the metrics that is measured and reported on an almost daily basis by many of our governments and public health agencies. Dr. Menzies, in a recent op-ed piece of yours, you said we have not seen any coherent testing strategy. You've also suggested that here in Canada, the government ought to test 9 million Canadians over 3 months at a projected cost of over $1 billion. So I guess my question to you is that realistic? And what should a coherent testing strategy look like if we are to emerge from this pandemic quickly?
Thanks, Derek. So first, I think we said 9 million, not 90. Did I hear you say 90? Anyway.
No, nine. I don't think. We have 90 million Canadians.
No, exactly. So so in terms of a coherent strategy, what we've said is, following on Tim's comment, that it's the asymptomatic persons that are not being diagnosed now that are contributing enormously to the transmission. Our feeling is that you need to test people who are asymptomatic, but how do you go about that? You can't just test willy-nilly. It's probably not wise to just set up a booth on the corner of the street and test people going by. You need to think about who's at risk, who's exposed, and is there some sort of priority that you can create? So, for example, we know that contacts, especially close contacts, are at high risk of being infected. Estimates vary anywhere from 10% to 40%, depending on the study, of contacts are infected. Of those, probably the majority are asymptomatic, especially if you go out and test early. The next group would be people who have a lot of exposure to patients who are themselves infected, which is, of course, healthcare workers. Very important group to be testing systematically and probably regularly. How regularly is another whole debate. And then the next group would be people who have a lot of public exposure. So your grocery store employees are possibly getting infected. And if they're feeling well, they keep going to work, of course. So maybe not only they get infected, but they're now transmitting back to the next group of customers. So I think there's a hierarchy. You can work out who should be tested highest priority, next priority, and so on. We've also suggested that school children and people working in schools should be tested when schools are reopened in the fall as a way to, again, stay safe. Do we need to test everybody? We kind of presented the upper end of the bill, if you will. $1 billion seems like a lot. But I see in the news that the federal government is running a deficit of $340 billion because of COVID. So I think $1 billion for testing to reopen the economy is probably a pretty reasonable investment compared to $340 billion that they're losing.
Great. So, thank you for that answer. Let me turn to you, Dr. Solin. I guess the question I would have is, how do we persuade people to get tested if they're feeling fine, displaying no symptoms of the virus? Are there strategies that governments, you know, can think about putting in place to get more people tested? You know, what are your thoughts on that?
Working a little bit off of what Dr. Menzies was saying, you know, having these tiered priorities, identifying groups of people who are both most at risk to themselves and also both most at risk for transmitting to others is critically important. We would hope, at least we're trying to cheer you on in Canada, that you would do a better job of having a national testing strategy than we are likely to achieve here in the U.S. My wish would be that either the federal or state governments would put together some kind of mandatory testing requirements for big employers. Once you have a lot of employees at risk, including hotels, meatpacking plants, Amazon warehouses, we have, to what Dr. Evans was saying earlier, although we have to be humble about all the things we don't know, there's a lot of things we do know. We already know what kind of workplaces are more dangerous than others. Bars, for instance. We expect university students as they come back. These are all high priority groups where we feel quite strongly that some government intervention to mandate testing is going to be critical since the risk to the general community is so high. I'm going to maybe pause here and maybe Dr. Hecht can jump in. I don't mean to preempt you, Derek, but he has other things that he wanted to say on this related topic. I didn't want to steal his thunder.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead on that. You know, another question I had, maybe that's what you're going to get at, is why is the testing in the US and Canada lagging behind the levels that you feel are needed to maintain strong surveillance? I'll let you jump in on with your thoughts on that.
Okay, thanks, Derek. Look, in general, in the U.S., we ought to be testing 1 to 2 million people a day. Right now, we're just at 600,000 a day. And Dick is calling for scaled-up testing in Canada, too. I guess the 9 million over in Nikhil Bhajwani have called assurance testing in their recent article in the Harvard Business Review. And it's this third kind of testing that's going to absorb the lion's share of all the tests in Canada and in the U.S. And this testing of the high-risk asymptomatics that Tim pointed to, it's just hugely important. We argued this, Shannon and I, back at the end of April in an opinion piece in the New York Times. Tim and Dick could perhaps put their fingers on why testing in Canada is not as high as it should be. But at least in Canada, you have a very well-coordinated federal and provincial policy framework, and you can use the provincial health insurance system to drive testing in a coherent way. Here in the U.S., things are really chaotic and fragmented because of the nature of our health system, which is also fragmented, and by the lack of overall federal leadership on COVID-19. In the U.S., to come to your question, Derek, we need to use a range of measures to try to improve both the supply and the demand side of testing. These days, I think the demand side is more important than supply, except in a few places like Florida and Arizona, where people can't get tests that they need. I'm hopeful that in most of the U.S., the demand for testing will rise in the next few months because employers and trade unions are going to spur this increase. And I think the universities in the U.S. that want to open in September will also greatly boost the amount of testing. So my view is that there are measures we can take that we're on the cusp of taking here in the U.S. to increase the amount of testing being done, but it's going to be a tough slog in the next few months. We'll see what happens. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Okay, great. Thanks for that. I do want to, before we move on from the subject of testing, and I do want to get to some other issues, including the reopening of societies and schools. But I do want to ask you, Dr. Evans, about the antibody testing, which is a separate kind of testing. So I know when you were last on the webcast at the end of April, you had just been named one of the heads of Canada's COVID-19 Immunity Task Force. So this is really not about testing people actively with the nose swabs, as we know, but more of a blood testing to determine if people might have antibodies in their system that would indicate that they'd already previously been infected with the virus, whether or not they showed symptoms. So can you tell us where we are as a country here in Canada in that process? And do we have a sense yet about the accuracy of these antibody tests in terms of determining who might have already been infected and therefore be immune from a potential second wave?
Yeah. Great. Well, thanks, Derek, and thanks to Rob, Shan, and Dick for those great comments. In terms of the COVID-19 Immunity Task Force, we were created in April, late April, and there were no approved antibody tests at that time in Canada. So we've come a long way now. We've got 4 approved antibody tests that are very accurate, very highly performing. And that's absolutely critical because not all antibody tests are high performing. And we've seen, in fact, Dick Menzies and some colleagues of his have recently published a very important paper in the British Medical Journal, which describes some of the problems with the accuracy. So first and foremost, the task force has said, make sure if we're doing these studies in Canada, we use accurate tests. and we have a very good test now. The challenge is that these tests have to work with blood that's drawn from a vein. They're not good We don't have good tests that can be used at home using a pinprick or another sense of what the background levels of infection are. And then we're moving this to more well-designed platforms that give us insights on the elderly or children, in addition to insights we might get from the blood banks. But in general, the first principle of the task force is to get a sense of what that full picture of infection looks like. And what we've seen from studies elsewhere is that you can expect anywhere from 8 to as much as 20 times more people being infected than are being detected using the nasal swabs. And so this gives you a sense of the base of the iceberg, the numbers of people who are infected and who are completely asymptomatic. It gives you a sense of the patterns of transmission. And it also gives you denominators, which are important to understanding the infection fatality rate. And when we have those denominators, we realize that it's, the number of people who get this infection and die is somewhere around 1% or less, as opposed to 6 or more percent when we look at the case fatality rate. So it gives you a better perspective on that. So that's the first area. The second is we need to understand what it means to show antibodies in the blood. Does this protect you from infection fully or partially? Will you get reinfected or not? And how long will that protection last? These are real questions. And to do that, what we're doing is we're following out populations that have been infected and with antibodies and are showing antibodies and looking at over time what that antibody response looks like and indeed whether or not it will be protective in terms of reinfection. So that's the second major area, and those studies are just getting underway. Obviously, they'll take a longer time before we have results. But they'll give us a really important insights on what antibody response means, what's the nature of the immune response, how strong it is protective, and how...
That as well, I'd say that it is certainly surprising. I had heard that some of the favela in Rio de Janeiro, they're looking at 25 to 30% serology positive, which I thought was already an astounding number, but to hear about 50 to 60% positive in some neighborhoods, which tend to be the poorest neighborhoods in New York City, which again perhaps reflects the difficulties of access to care, poor access to diagnosis, and maybe also greater crowding and that sort of thing. So these populations are obviously very at risk, and that's why perhaps we're seeing the excess of mortality, because again, that tip of the iceberg is the mortality that we're seeing in these same population groups that are poor, disadvantaged. So on the other hand, apparently, frankly, the richer neighborhoods, much, much lower prevalence of antibodies. Again, I haven't seen the original article, so you'd want to know about the test itself, what was used, and whether there was good specificity, obviously, no false positives. But I think it tells you that in some neighborhoods, yeah, you're reaching those levels of herd immunity, but at really a terrible cost. That's the problem with herd immunity. It's all very well to talk about it, but you know, Boris Johnson, I think, talked about herd immunity until he ended up in the ICU and sequelae.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thanks for that, I guess, sobering reflection on the news out of New York this morning. Yeah. So let me turn now to sort of this notion of reopening our societies, which we sort of hinted at in some of the conversation around the testing. Dr. Solin, in an op-ed piece that you and Dr. Hecht co-published in the Boston Globe in June, you said, and I'll quote you here, "The shape of the second wave will be the direct product of our collective actions." So I'm wondering, what did you mean by that? And how should governments and individuals approach the reopening of society in a way that might prevent a second wave?
Well, we wrote that sentence to try to encourage people to fully recognize and understand that what everyone is doing is contributing to the case curves that we're seeing every day and that we're monitoring very closely. It's everyone's individual actions about whether they maintain social distance, how well they wore their masks, how much they washed their hands, and just how much proximity they were keeping from other people. This virus doesn't care about your political affiliations. It doesn't care about where you live. It's just seeking other hosts, which is what all viruses do. And by continuing to congregate in churches, in bars, in restaurants, in poorly ventilated places, those are choices. And that's in contrast to what Dr. Menzies was saying. Some of these disadvantaged neighborhoods, you have highly dense people living together. They don't have choices. So I'm trying to separate choice and not choice. But what everyone is doing together in aggregate is what makes that disease curve. So it should not be surprising to people that, you know, we're focusing a lot today and in the news on a second wave. We're not out of the first wave yet. I would say out of the US, we're doing better here in Massachusetts. In Canada, I think you've done a very nice job of flattening your curve, and maybe you can make an argument that you had survived your first wave, but this is not a virus that has gone away. And I don't think it's one that we're winning yet. I still think the virus is in control, or is at least has the potential to come roaring back. And the shape of that second curve, how bad it is, how many more lives it takes in all the other places in Canada and the US who have not achieved quasi-herd immunity, even assuming that that's a real thing, and that came at a very heavy cost to Brooklyn, Queens, Chelsea here in Massachusetts. There's many places that we can name where they may have achieved herd immunity, but at tremendous amounts of death and suffering and cost to the health system. All of that avoidance is really going to be dependent on how much we respect this virus and how much personal sacrifice and accountability that we're willing to take as a society to maintain distance whenever we can.
Mm-hmm. Great. So Dr. Hecht, maybe to follow up on that point, I know we've seen reports of huge surges in infections in the last week or two in places like Florida, Texas, and Arizona, to name just a few. Does this mean, in your opinion, that we are, in fact, moving too quickly as a society in terms of reopening? And what lessons can those of us, let's say, here in Canada, where things are better, what lessons can we or should we take from what we're seeing south of the border?
Well, thanks, Derek. Yes, the answer is that these states like Arizona and Texas and Florida and Mississippi have moved much too quickly and frankly recklessly over the last 6 weeks. I don't think there's any question about it, and it's very distressing to see that. During the lockdown phase back in April, May, these states were never really very serious and compliant about the stay-at-home orders, the distancing, the mask use, all these non-pharmaceutical measures. And we know that mask use has been much lower in those parts of the country than say here in the northeastern U.S., the mid-Atlantic and Northeast. And in many cases, the political leaders, the governors and the mayors, were very cavalier about COVID, dismissing it or doubting its seriousness, and not showing the kind of leadership that's needed, not listening to their own public health officials. These states, just like every state here in the U.S., established certain goals and targets for moving into the reopening, the phased approach, which we've had here in the U.S., more or less copying Centers for Disease Control federal guidelines. These have been gateways or measures like seeing hospital beds empty out or reduce the load, or bringing down the number of tests that prove to be positive to under 5% or 2%. But in these states like Florida and Arizona and Texas, when these states just failed to meet their own targets, the targets they set for themselves, they just went ahead and moved to the next phase of reopening, going from outdoor dining to indoor dining and so on and so forth before they were ready. They just drove right through the red lights that were flashing because they didn't really care, or they weren't willing to accept the fact that they weren't green and they were on cruise control. They weren't going to stop. And as a result, the community transmission in these states continued in the spring and never really abated that much. It was like an ember burning slowly in the underbrush. And then when they reopened, it's burst into flames, and it's now just a huge fire, which they're unable to contain. So what do they need to do? Frankly, they're not going to reverse things unless they roll back some of the reopening measures. That's going to be very hard politically and economically for them to do. But at least they could target those measures that are really fueling the fire the most. It's not everything they've done that's causing this resurgence. Reopening bars and nightclubs, allowing people to congregate again, unfortunately, in houses of worship where they crowd together and they sing, having them get together in densely packed crowds on the beaches and playgrounds, and just maintaining very poor distancing and mask practice in dense workplaces, like in meatpacking factories that we all hear about. And we're really worried that poorly planned and sloppily implemented reopening of undergraduate universities. You talked about schools, I think K-12, but we're very worried here in the U.S. about the reopening of the undergraduate universities and colleges, where it's going to be very hard to test and to control the spread of COVID. So those are the areas really where these states are going to need to step in if they're going to target these high-risk situations. And then at least they'd have some chance, even a small chance, of bringing these outbreaks under control. So we'll see in the next few months if they have the courage politically and from a public health point of view to act wisely. But the signs as of today are just not very encouraging. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Great. So I feel like we can't have a proper discussion on this topic at about sort of, you know, the role of public health and people's ability to follow guidelines without talking about face masks. Seems to be the topic du jour, at least this week here in Canada. So maybe I'll turn back to you, Dr. Solin, on this. I know that you were calling for universal use of face masks back in a Boston Globe article as early as mid-March. Just this week here in Canada, we've seen some interesting developments. So the cities of Toronto and Ottawa have made face masks mandatory now in all indoor shops and public spaces. And the mayor of Montreal announced this week that her city will enact a similar law by the end of the month. And yet, as Dr. Heck referenced earlier, the debate around face masks seems to become so politicized, especially where you are in the United States. So I'm wondering, why do you think this is the case, and what impact might this have on preventing a second wave?
Well, thanks, Derek. Masks are my favorite topic, as I'm not... Just going back a little bit, both Dr. Hecht and I felt very strongly in March that because we didn't have anything else, we don't have a vaccine, we don't have a drug, all of these so-called non-pharmaceutical interventions, which include masking, social distancing, hand washing, et cetera, would be really critical because you have nothing else. So I think here in the US, it's been complicated and troubled, I would say, to get people to accept mask use. The CDC and the federal government did not help by at first saying masks don't work. This was actually just untrue. It was done because there was a fear that people, lay people, would start to hoard medical masks, surgical ones and N95 masks that are so desperately needed by health workers, that they released information that was untrue. And I think that reversal and this kind of clumsy reversal to say, well, actually, we didn't know about asymptomatic transmission, also not true. But masks can now help against that. This kind of 180, and in an environment where trust of experts is not as high as one would hope, has done a lot to erode public confidence in masks. The other disappointing thing, at least here in the US, is that, as you said, masking has just become so politicized. It's not seen as a tool of prevention anymore. It's seen as a symbol of your affiliation to a particular political party. It's seen as an infringement on personal rights. And to me, I don't really understand, A, why people feel they have the right to put others in danger, and also why people feel like they don't have a responsibility to keep everyone safe. These are just things that I think on a human level are very confusing to me. And especially when the request to put a mask on is to me very, very small. Dr. Hecht and I have been wearing our masks since February. I'm not a runner anymore, but he'll run with his mask. I mean, if you just keep it on all the time, you get used to it. It's a very small inconvenience to keep people safe. And I would say that masks are integral to flattening that second wave. I thought masks were important in March. I didn't realize even myself how important they would be. There's been a lot more, I think, pretty good evidence right now, more studies that are being done that show really if everyone wore masks, if 80% of us wore masks, it would almost be as good as a vaccine from some simulations. But it requires, again, complete, near population compliance to do this. And I'm personally not confident that the US will do that. And I hope that there's better luck in Canada. You know, we're half the year we're in winter anyway. We're already covering our faces with scarves. So I think that it's a small ask to make, and hopefully Canadians will be wiser and smarter and kinder to each other. And I would say that we're right here in the US and willing to make very small sacrifices.
Great. Dr. Menzies, you want to jump in on that?
Well, I think one of the issues with the masks is that you're actually protecting others. If you happen to have the asymptomatic infection, wearing the mask is not protecting you from inhaling the virus, it's actually protecting others. And that perhaps that fundamental understanding is not out there. Most people wear masks thinking I'm protecting myself. And that's true, that it's not clear that works. On the other hand, wearing the mask, if you have the infection, that's where it has an impact, right?
That's true. Mm-hmm. But here in the US, they don't care. It's just more about...
Well, I know, but I think even the basic understanding is lost on people. And so when they hear it doesn't work, you know, some people, experts may say, well, it doesn't work to wear it. It doesn't protect you from inhaling the virus. That's actually true. Right, especially now that we think it's...
There's been certain studies, I think, that have been relatively well done, that if you have multi-layered masks, they can perform as well as surgical masks. And it's not ever going to be as good as an N95, but there is some barrier protection, too, against at least larger droplets.
Yeah, so I think... Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say it works in both directions, predominantly in preventing things coming in, but it also does prevent you from also pushing things out.
I think Dr. Evans wants to weigh in as well on that.
Yeah, just that as somebody who's straddled both sides of the border due to failures in family planning of my parents, I have some association with the American psyche, and I do think that what Dick is saying is making a really important thing, which is that you're actually protecting others insofar as you're unconsciously or unaware, as most asymptomatic people are, that they may be shedding virus. My suggestion would be, in opening up, is that you promote an epidemic of masquerade balls, in which you popularize in some real way masks as being much more socially acceptable, and try, as opposed to take a hardline view, which I think in some respects is provoking that individualist live free and die type of mentality, which you see on the license plates in New Hampshire. The other thing I think, though, is really important, Dick is making as a point, is that every individual here in the epidemic is an agent of public health, and your behavior matters. And so I think it's not simply the mask wearing, it's respecting social distancing, where we've got good evidence now that you at least 1 meter or two, your likelihood of getting infected goes down. But also the most effective therapeutic or preventive we have is soap. Wash your hands. Viruses dissipate and disappear when you use soap, and soap is available everywhere. So some of these things, they seem obvious, but they do make a difference, and they really deserve to be reinforced. Really, I think, to go in line with what Rob and Sean have been suggesting, which is you can collectively manage in a much more proactive way the risk moving into a second wave. If you really bring together this evidence, which has individuals taking responsibility, in addition to ramping up testing systems, so that we have our eyes open with respect to where the epidemic is moving.
Okay, I think Dr. Heck, you wanted to jump in. If you can make it quickly, because we do have a lot of alumni questions.
I know, we're holding up the fantastic questions that I'm sure are coming in. I just wanted to reinforce what Tim said. He does read the American psyche extremely well. We were really pleased to see that none other than Dick Cheney, not Dick Menzies, but Dick Cheney, the other day went on in the media wearing a mask and promoting real men wear masks. That's the sort of thing mm-hmm. that can potentially change things. Unfortunately, even though our president's advisors and cabinet members all wear masks, especially when they're off camera, their commander in chief does not. So we have a role model problem here in this country. Thanks.
Well, perhaps what they need is to think about matching the MAGA hats, ball caps, with MAGA masks, perhaps. But let's move along away from masks for now. But thank you all for your insight on that. Let's turn, in fact, to some of the questions we got from our alumni, both ahead of this broadcast as well as some of them that are coming in right now. And if you do have any questions, I will try to squeeze some in. It's at aoc@mcgill.ca. Let's go back to this other hot topic that you referenced earlier, which is the reopening of schools this fall. We received lots of questions from people about schools. I'll start with this one. It comes from Leah Lash, BA98, who wrote to us from Richmond, Virginia. She wants to know if it's safe to send young preschool age kids back to school in the fall. Even if it's true they're not contracting COVID, are they able to spread it within their households? She says her 74-year-old mother lives with them, and she's afraid that her son could act as a conduit for the disease. Dr. Menzies, you want to jump in on that one? I see you nodding.
Thanks, Derek. Thanks, Leah. I think it's a very serious concern. That's personally my concern when people here go there, send their kids back to school or daycare, or now I see them in summer camps, is, yeah, the kids may have very mild disease, but the worry is that they bring it home and give it to their parents, grandparents, and so on. I think we don't, again, I don't have good, clear indication of how contagious kids are. There's maybe a bit of data, they're maybe a bit less contagious, but I don't think we can be confident to say they're not contagious. So I would be very concerned of that exact scenario. The child gets sick in the daycare, is totally asymptomatic or a minor, you know, sniffles, comes home, and the grandmother ends up in the ICU.
Mm-hmm. So we did get another question. I don't want to stick on masks, but this one touches on schools and masks. It came from Carol Heffernan, and she's asking whether students should wear masks in their classes throughout the day and on their school buses. Dr. Solin, maybe I'll let you jump in on that one with your mask expertise.
Yes, I think they should. But at the same time, you know, children, depending on their age, differ in how well they're able to keep masks on. So we know that children under 2, for instance, are not recommended to wear masks and for various reasons. Parents can do a lot by modeling good masking behavior themselves, explaining to children why it's important that they keep theirs on. Actually, maybe children are more pure than us adults, but there's been some behavioral change studies that have shown that if you explain to children it's to keep others safe, they like to keep it on better. But I would say certainly for enclosed spaces like school buses and schools where it's going to be very hard, if not impossible, for schools to maintain the social distance requirements. I think masking indoors is going to be very, very important.
Mm-hmm. Great. And one more question that came in regarding schools, I'll maybe direct this one to you, Dr. Heck, because it does reference colleges and universities, which you talked about earlier. This one is from Karen Kalawi from Nova Scotia. So she's wondering about the plans to welcome international students coming to study in Canada, and I suppose the same logic would apply in the United States. She says she knows of one university in her province that is planning to bring in students in 2-week waves so as to minimize the potential spread, and says it would be comforting to know that everyone crossing our borders has to quarantine before coming into contact with local kids. So does this make sense? And will international students be quarantining separately? And is this what might make the difference in having a safe return to university campuses this fall?
Thanks, Derek. Yes, I think that having those international students quarantine, especially if they're coming from south of the border, maybe that's implied in the question, is important. They're coming from Korea or from China, their risk profile is going to be lower, but it probably makes sense for both public health and equity reasons to have them all quarantine. And that's going to be extremely important to avoid imported cases of COVID in Canada in those university settings. That having been said, whether students are coming from nearby, just coming to McGill from the suburbs of Montreal, or coming from overseas, making sure that when they are in residence, if they're going to be in residence, I don't know what the policy is at McGill. I'll defer to Tim and others on that and to Dick. But I know at my university at Yale, the undergraduates are being selectively welcomed back in a selective pattern to de-densify the dorms. But those students have to be repeatedly tested. They have to wear masks. Classrooms are going to be very much change for teaching purposes to spread kids out, and if they have to attend large lecture format with hundreds of students, those courses are going to be delivered online. It's going to be a very complex hybrid situation at Yale to make sure that once those students are back, whether they're coming from nearby in Connecticut or coming from another part of the U.S. or from overseas, that there isn't an outbreak of COVID. It can not only spread within the school community to elderly faculty and workers and so on, but a lot of these universities are in urban settings, and students come into contact with others in the larger urban community. This represents a huge threat to those larger communities. This is something that we, Shannon and I, have been arguing about for the last couple of months, and calling for universities to do the right thing, but also to think about the larger environment they're embedded in. Again, they're not operating in isolation. They're part of larger cities and provinces and states, and they need to do things that are consistent with the collective benefit. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Menzies, you wanted to jump in on that point?
Yeah, again, I was glad to hear Robert mention testing, but again, maybe I'm a little obsessed with testing. I agree that masks are one of the strategy, hand washing, soap, et cetera, but testing is also a technology that we have. And while we still don't have a vaccine and we don't have effective treatment, I think we are still underemphasizing the utility of testing. It's benign. We've looked at saliva testing versus, you know, these nasopharyngeal swabs. And for children, I think it's, you know, something to consider. But repeated, you know, at least one-off testing when people start school, come back to school, your international students, maybe twice, you know, there's all debate about how often you need to test, but testing these groups of students, and of course, someone to analyze the data and say, there is a problem or we don't, there isn't a problem. We don't really need to do this again, but at least do it once so we know what we're dealing with.
Right, and Derek,
Dr. Evans,
just to follow up on Richard's good point, which is, I think, there's opportunities to lower risk considerably based on what we know. Testing is part of it. But I think we have to recognize that there will be cases. And the fact that there are cases does not mean that we have an epidemic. A case represents an outbreak. And outbreaks in many respects in the current setting are inevitable. What's unacceptable is letting an outbreak become an epidemic, because we have the ability through testing and contact tracing and isolation and other measures to make sure we get on top of that case so that outbreak does not become an epidemic. And I think it's very important to use all our measures in such a way that we don't say that, oh, because there's one case on the McGill campus, the whole university has to shut. No, we want to make sure that we're ready to deal with a case, we're expecting it, and we have every measure in place to make sure we're contact tracing and decreasing as much as possible the likelihood that that one case can become the match that leads to a massive epidemic. And so I think that mentality is important. One case, a couple of cases is not failure. Failure is not responding appropriately with the knowledge that we have to make sure those that one or a couple of cases don't become an epidemic.
Great, thank you. So we only have a few minutes left. I'll try to get to as many of these other questions as I can. So maybe I'll ask our panelists to maybe give some short answers to these. I'll stick with you, Dr. Evans, don't go too far. There's a great question that came in from John Childs. He's asking, how accurate are the COVID-19 numbers in Canada and in the rest of the world when we read how some governments do extensive testing while others do not?
Yeah. Well, I think there's great variability in the testing. And as Dr. Menzies said earlier in the call, unfortunately, there's been an absence of coherent strategy to testing within and across countries. And therefore, if you look at Canada's strategy or Canada's approach to testing, up until mid to late March, we were simply testing people with recent foreign travel and symptoms. And it's only recently that we've started to see some major changes in testing, which would recognize asymptomatic cases. So I think because of that variability, one has to look at the data and look at the numbers tested. But there are some data that help compare, and it's the tests positive per million, the number of tests per million. These rates give you a sense of the levels of testing in countries and also the percent positive. And so those types of measures, which you can get on most of the worldometers and other things, are helpful in identifying reasonably reliable trends. So despite the absence, there are ways in which we can make some sense of that data. But I want to go back to what Dick said earlier. We really need to invest in more coherent strategies for testing in order to get on top of the epidemic.
Great. So Dr. Menzies, I'll turn the next question over to you. It sort of ties into that. This one just came into us from Margaret Rudolph. And hold on, I had it right here. She wants to know whether the cost of testing is a deterrent for some governments, and if you can comment on how the US and Canada are approaching the issue of costs.
So that's a great question, because the RT-PCR technology is fairly costly. Although when we've looked at it, it turns out it's really gathering the samples, getting the samples to the lab, the protective equipment that actually account for maybe 80% of total costs. So 20% is the test and 80% is everything else. And there are a lot of ways you can drive down that cost, especially if you're doing planned systematic testing. You can really push the cost per test down. So that $1 billion we estimate is a really upper end of the range. And we've looked at kind of fairly simple solutions that would drive that cost down to less than half if you are doing it with a bit more organization and planning. Mm-hmm. And then there are, you know, made in Canada, PCR tests that are spearheaded by another group at McGill. Just want to plug that for a moment. You know, so a group of researchers started in March saying, oh my God, there's no PCR available in Canada, which was a huge problem and was part of the problem at the beginning for sure. And they're now at a point where they've produced high quality, accurate RT-PCR tests for, they're not allowing me to say, but it's less cost. And they can produce millions of tests with a bit of government support. So it can be done, and I think costs can dramatically go down with greater volume. And frankly, again, as Dr. Evans keeps saying, a coherent government strategy.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. Let me turn this next one over to you, Dr. Solin. This one came in as well in the last couple of minutes from Tony Rupchinski. Interesting question. He wants to know what parameters define a second wave versus just a continuation of the first wave.
That's a good question. I mean, I guess it's the shape. It's like how much, I'll take Massachusetts as an example. I mean, we peaked very high. We were having, I guess, over 3,000 cases identified at our peak. But back to what Dr. Evans was saying, with 20 or 30% positivity rates coming back. And now we are at less than 200 cases statewide. And just for parameters, we are a state of 7 million people. So maybe about the size of Quebec, about the size of Ontario, a little bit, roughly. And our prevalence rates for testing, we're still testing between 8 and 10,000 people per day, and the tests are coming back around 1 or 2%. So that tells you that you're testing broadly, you're not finding very many cases, and it's, you know, 98% lower than it was at its high point. I watch the dashboard every day with bated breath, because between 4th of July, between we're in phase three now of reopening. They just reopened indoor dining, gyms. I don't know how we can keep it at this level much longer, personally. But I'm trying to be an optimist about this. But that's how you would know. You need to suppress the first wave low enough that you could see if it was starting to come back. You want to keep it as low as possible.
Right, right.
2% test positivity or less.
Okay, so I think we might have time for maybe one or two more questions. This one came in earlier from David Winch. He's actually questioning concerns around the second wave. It was a long email, so I'll do my best to paraphrase it. But he's a big supporter of Sweden's lighter lockdown model and says he sees no strong epidemiological reason for a second wave. He says that the most similar pandemic to ours today was the 1957-58 Asian flu pandemic, which started in China and killed 116,000 Americans and perhaps 150,000 in Europe. And note that there was no second wave in 1959 or 1960. Why should COVID be different? Anyone want to jump in on that one?
I'm guessing that they had herd immunity, that the case fatality rate was a lot less with that flu. That would be my supposition. Whereas here we know from serology studies that a lot smaller proportion of the population have been infected with COVID in most places in the world. So in BC, Quebec, et cetera, it's a very small fraction that have been infected.
Okay, Dr. Solin?
I would also add that it's not the same as flu for many reasons, but because this is a brand new virus to us. Everyone in the world is naive to it. The flu, although there's some bad ones, and that one was a bad one, there's still some partial immunity that exists among the population as well that blunts it. So I don't think that comparisons between COVID-19 and flu are appropriate. And also Sweden, I don't think is a good example, but we can discuss that another time.
Okay, Doctor, I see a lot of hands up. Doctor Evans, if you could keep it short.
Well, again, I think it goes back to humility. I think we really don't know. We were concerned about a second wave with SARS, and we never saw it, and that was a coronavirus. Coronavirus is different from flu, even though we've made lots of comparisons. The mortality profile from Spanish flu, very, very different from the mortality profile we're seeing from this novel coronavirus. So I think the basic answer is we don't know. But I think more fundamentally, I don't think we can afford not to be prepared. And I think in the absence of that knowledge with the, as Dick said, we know that there are many, many susceptibles in many places, especially in Canada, where we, you know, the consequence of doing a good job on the first wave is we have lots of folks, the majority of the population who have not been exposed. And so if we have another wave, as we've seen the resurgence in the southern United States, that travels, barrels up the Mississippi and into our prairie provinces, there's lots of susceptibles there, which would lead to, in my view, an opportunity for spread, unless we're incredibly well prepared. So I think we have to be prepared for a second wave, whether it comes or not.
It doesn't.
I saw your hand up, Dr. I had one more question for you, but if you want to jump in on this one.
Okay, well, it may be related to your question. I don't know. I was just going to tie this in a little bit with the search for a vaccine. I suspect that's on the minds of a lot of people. And we're all watching the many darts that are being thrown at the dartboard right now. A lot of U.S. and European and Canadian and other financing going into both the upfront development in the labs of these vaccine candidates, and then lots of price and volume guarantees to buy an efficacious vaccine. I think there have been stories about the U.S. government putting billions of dollars into vaccines. I just want to point out that's mostly in the form of contingent willingness to buy the vaccine if it proves to be efficacious. That money's not going out the door to these unproven vaccines and vaccine companies right away. But I don't think any of us expects a vaccine to be working and to be available in large quantity before next year. And there's still a lot of uncertainty around that. So I think it only reinforces what everybody's saying about being prepared for the second wave. We're not going to have a vaccine in time. I don't think we should certainly hold out hope that that's going to solve all our problems.
Great. Well, Dr. Heck, thank you. And you did suspect correctly my last question to you was going to be about the vaccines, and a question specific to an article that appeared a couple of days ago in the New York Times about the U.S. government committing billions of dollars to a company to develop a vaccine that doesn't quite exist yet. But I think you've answered that well. So listen, we're just about at the top of the hour, and that does wrap up the time we have today. I would have loved to have gotten some additional thoughts from all of you. This has been an incredibly exciting and fascinating conversation, but we are sadly out of time. Before we close, I would like to remind everyone that this video will be available at this very same link soon after a recording ends. So feel free to share it with others who may not have been able to tune in live. And of course, a big thank you to our incredibly knowledgeable panelists, Tim Evans and Dick Menzies from McGill's Faculty of Medicine, and Robert Hecht and Shan Solin from Global Health Advisors and Yale University, for taking time out of what I know are your extremely busy schedules to come on with us today and share such important and valuable insight. Before we close, I would like to take a moment to pay special tribute to a dear McGill friend and supporter who passed away on June 27th, and that is Cappy Flanders. Not only was Cappy an advocate and champion of so many programs here at McGill, including being the driving force behind the McGill Council on Palliative Care, the Canadian Palliative Care Initiative, and the popular series of McGill mini courses for lifelong learners, but she was also a big supporter of all of our efforts to expand McGill expertise to the community, including this series of alumni webcasts. In fact, when we began this series in March, Cappy was often the very first person to email me as soon as we went off the air, providing high praise and sometimes constructive feedback on everything from the quality of the conversation, the knowledge of our guests, and even the contents of the bookcase behind me. Cappy will sorely be missed across the McGill community, but her contributions will long be remembered by the many people she helped, supported, and befriended during her incredible life. And so on behalf of all of us at McGill, we dedicate today's webcast to her memory. Thank you.
CKUT
Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
Welcome to CKUT 90.3 World Skip the Beat. I'm your host for the day, Prudence Gendron. And today we're going to be taking a look at the wide and wonderful and oftentimes weird and sometimes wacky, never not whimsical, and frequently verboten world of Calypso.
Shake, 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 Sinora, shake your body line. Shake, Sinora, shake it all the time. Work, Sinora, work your body line. Work, work, Sinora, work it all the time. This air is a new kind of rhythm, Calypso band. Come out and dance, I tell you, brother.
Jump in the line, rock your body in time.
Okay, I believe you.
Jump in the line, rock your body in
please
time.
Please rock your body.
Jump in the line, rock your body in time.
Somebody help me.
Jump in the line, rock your body in time.
When I say rock your body, I mean so. Left to right in the tempo. In case you get a sensation, jump up in the air, come down in slow motion.
Jump in the line, rock your body in time.
Okay, I believe you.
Jump in the line, rock your body in time.
Please when I'm hungry. When I leave me out on a Monday, I won't come back till next Tuesday evening.
Jump in the line, rock your body in time.